Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. This week, the hirsute Red Sox won the Commissioner's Trophy in Game 6 of the World Series, the first time they pulled it off at home since 1918. There is no telling whether the bushy Boston beards that first showed up during spring training gave them the good luck during the postseason, but even the most rational of fans would have been aghast if they'd all decided to shave halfway through the playoffs. Author and research psychologist Stuart Vise studies the science and psychology of superstition and how it influences our behavior. We read his recent article for The Atlantic called How Superstition Works and caught up with him to better understand the power of the Red Sox beard and other talismans. Stuart Vise, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
People pass around a lot of different superstitions of athletes. What are some that stick out to you?
Well, there are so many athletic superstitions, it would be hard to list them all. But I make a lot of noise about Wade Boggs, who used to play for the Red Sox, who believed that eating chicken helped him hit. And so he ate chicken before every single game and actually had a chicken recipe book that he and his wife put out called Foul Tips. But there have been many sports superstitions. Michael Jordan was supposed to have worn a certain pair of underwear for every game that dated back to his days in North Carolina. And, of course, we currently have the beards going in Boston.
Tell me about the beards.
There are a number of things. These are team superstitions. This is a team superstition, and so it clearly has a sort of positive social bonding effect. It's quite visible. You know that you're a part of something when you can see it that way. And there's also, with that, they were apparently coming off a pretty bad season last year and started to grow their beards and had some success. And so whenever you do something that seems to be working, there's a tendency to want to hold on to that and keep it going as long as possible. And we'll see whether it works or not. Baseball in particular is rife with superstition. The reason for this in part is that it is an old game. It has a lot of traditions, but also it's a really slow game, you may have noticed. And and so there's all this time when you're not actively moving that needs to be filled somehow. So a number of the baseball superstitions were things that you could do in the dugout when you were sitting waiting to be a part of the game again. Rally caps used to be very popular, where if a team got down behind the other team, they would start to wear their hats upside down or with the bills turned up or something all at once as a team in an effort to bring on hits. So there are quite a few. Some of them are team superstitions. Others are more individual, like the eating chicken.
You cite a number of different researchers for a number of different types of superstition in your article. I'm wondering if anyone has ever researched whether or not they work. Is it measurable, you know, that if you wear the same pair of socks turned inside out day after day after day, that you do better?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but for a long time, no one actually did look into that. And I mean, I think there's an assumption that there isn't any real magic in the world, at least on the part of most researchers. That may be disappointing to a lot of people, but there isn't any clear evidence of sort of a magical effect. What has been shown, a couple of years ago, some German researchers did a fascinating study in which they had people come into the laboratory and putt a golf ball into a cup. So they were doing an actual skilled activity. And for half of the people, they just handed them the ball and said, go at it. For the other half, they handed them the ball and said, this ball has been lucky today.
Hmm.
The result was that the people who were told the ball was lucky were able to putt better, significantly better than the other group. And so I think that there's no question that these superstitions do have an effect on performance. It's not a magical effect, but it's one that builds confidence in the player and makes the player feel as though they've done one more thing to try to bring about a good end.
Are athletes especially prone to superstition?
Oh, absolutely. There are a couple of reasons why. One is that professional athletes you know, this is their livelihood, and they have quite a bit on the line. And yet, at the same time, you can't be sure of success. I mean, you know, the best hitters, it's frequently been said that the best hitters in baseball only get a hit about a third of the time, you know. So making sure that you actually get a hit is impossible. You can just do the best you can. This is exactly the right circumstance for superstition to be brought in to try to, you know, eke out a little bit more certainty and predictability in the world.
Well, it does kind of go both ways. I mean, we kiss the die for good luck. We avoid walking under a ladder because it's bad luck. Do you think that superstition plays a positive or negative role in our lives?
Well, you've hit on an important point. I think that, first of all, what seems to be the case is that the negative ones and the positive ones are sort of different categories. First of all, I'm as a scientist, I don't think anyone should believe in things that are unproven or, you know, don't have scientific support. But at the same time, I recognize that in the case of the positive superstitions, they undoubtedly have a beneficial psychological effect on the person who's doing it, at least when it comes to skilled activities. Believing in a lucky charm will not help you at the roulette table because it's just chance. But on the job, in a job interview, in a performance on stage or on the playing field, then the possibility is there. When it comes to the negative superstitions like Friday the 13th and so forth, I really see no upside to those. Those are things that we would be better off if someone had not bothered to teach us about those things. Because now if you're at all superstitious and fearful, then, you know, you have to deal with it each time it appears, and you either have to face it or you have to make other arrangements.
Stuart Vyse, author and psychologist. You can find out more about his writing on superstition and find a link to his recent article in The Atlantic at wordofmouthradio.org. Stuart, thank you.
My pleasure.
Among comedian Will Ferrell's memorable Saturday Night Live characters was musician Gene Frankel, the belly-shirted cowbell player from the 70s rock band Blue Oyster Cult.
But the last time I checked, we don't have a whole lot of songs that feature the cowbell.
I gotta have more cowbell, baby.
And I'd be doing myself a disservice and every member of this band if I didn't perform the hell out of this.
Guess what? I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
And that last line, delivered by Christopher Walken, catapulted onto T-shirts and bumper stickers and helped put the instrument designed for agriculture into the mainstream musical spotlight. But where did the cowbell come from, and how did it migrate from the farm to the recording studio? Chicago-based journalist Lori Rotenberg wrote an article for Modern Farmer called More Cowbell, From Herdsman's Tool to Cultural Icon, and joins us now on the line. Lori, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much, and it's nice to speak to you this afternoon.
Lori, when did we first see evidence of the use of a cowbell, and before it was used for any musical purpose, how was it used in agriculture?
Well, it goes back 10,000 years, and it would have been used for a lot of different animals, mainly sheep, lambs, anything that would be in a flock and that a herdsman or a shepherd would want to keep watch of where they were. For example, for a cow, they had a lead cow that would lead to pasture, sometimes often a bigger cow, a stronger cow, and that specific animal would wear a larger bell. And let's say there's a calf out there, a younger animal, younger lamb, they would wear a smaller bell, and that way it allowed the herdsman as well as the rest of the animals in the herd or flock to be able to tell where a specific animal would be.
What were they made of?
They could be made of anything. In the early days, they were made out of snail shells, stone, bronze, wood, and up to the, you know, current time of metal.
How did it go from there to being used in music?
From research and talking to a musicologist who's mentioned in the article by the name of David Ludwig, it happened because, let's take Mahler and Strauss, for example, ones that where they can really, you know, mark the time of when it happened. Classical work started calling for pastoral segments in them, pastoral phrases, and some things that the composers were doing, and it was very avant-garde. And so to create that mood within a symphony, I think the first was Mahler. He decided to use a cowbell and had his percussionist actually walk among the orchestra players with the cowbell around his neck and, you know, rattle it a little bit. And the two works would be Alpine Symphony, and then for Mahler, it was Symphony No. 6.
Number six is what? It's so early 20th century, right?
Right.
And it's supposed to be about tragedy, but cowbells I think of as a kind of a cheerful sound.
Well, for Mahler, it was bringing up his past of growing up in a rural area, and it was a sound he so loved and I think wished to hear again, from everything from cow parades to being close to pastures, that for him it was the sound, the last beautiful, peaceful sound you would hear on earth before heading up to the great beyond, was his reason for it. So there was a dark element to it. You know, it was the death, but the last sound you would hear.
A little bit of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 6. Mahler was one of the first composers to use the cowbell in orchestral works. We can hear it clanging there in the background. But the cowbell eventually became an essential percussion sound for studio musicians in rock and roll. How did it get from Mahler to Honky Tonk Woman with the Rolling Stones?
Well, what occurred was, as the works were performed through time in symphony halls, what they would do to better control the ping was they removed the clapper and started tapping on it with a drumstick or other item the percussionist might use. So that sound became something then that people began to understand, and it just became part of the percussionist's arsenal. And, you know, eventually just made its way into other realms of music. It would go into Latin music, jazz, you know, rock and roll, because it was already part of the bag that they would pull things out of that they would use for sound, you know, which showed up in vaudeville for background sound.
You also spoke with the percussionist Glenn Kochi, who plays drums for the band Wilco, also performs solo percussion in an adventurous musical sort, certainly, often using the cowbell. Let's hear a little bit from him. Lori Rotenberg is with us. She wrote an article for Modern Farmer called More Cowbell, From Herdsman's Tool to Cultural Icon. We're sort of tracing how it made its way from the field into the recording studio, and there being played by Glenn Kochi, percussionist for Wilco. What did he tell you about his use and love of the cowbell?
He's loved the cowbell since a youth. It was the first item he bought for his drum kit when he was a young teen, you know, 12, 13 years old. And what he loves about it is that it rides above all the other sounds. Glenn does not use cowbells that you would buy from a store, you know, where you would order from a musical store and get one that's made to fit on a kit. He likes authentic cowbells that he sources from junk stores and shops when he travels around the world. So he has a collection of at least 1,000 different types of cowbells.
Wow.
And he does keep some umglocken mounted on his drum kit for specific works, and those are bells that are tuned. But he just loves the sound that they make, and he said they're a wonderful rhythm tool, you know, something to keep the rhythm, but they ride above everything else. The sound is so distinctive.
What is the state of the cowbell now, though? Are farmers still even using them, or is it just musicians?
No, farmers are using them, and having an interview with Matt Bevan, the man who had Bevan Bell Company, the one that burned down in Connecticut, he had seen a rise in sales again as more young farmers go back into farming and follow the sustainability movement. They were going back to more 19th century farming, and this isn't all of them, of course, but a good number, and they started using the cowbells again. On larger farms across the country and even in Europe, they're now using GPS. They put a chip in a cow and follow the herd that way. But there was a resurgence of animals wearing the bells again, and you will still find it, you know, a great deal, especially in the Midwest.
Lori, any favorite tunes of yours that proudly feature the cowbell?
Oh, let's see. I think probably one that, from doing the research, it would have been Def Leppard's Rock of Ages, and I think It's cowbell at its best.
To read Lori Rotenberg's article on the history of the cowbell and modern farmer, you can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to hear your favorite songs featuring the mighty cowbell. Let us know on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or tweet us at Word of Mouth. We'll be back in a minute with a gruesome story that you may have heard before, Cinderella. We're going to discover the grim roots of a classic fairy tale when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Halloween is a perfect time for ghost stories and fairy tales. Yes, fairy tales. Not the sanitized stuff of Disney princesses, but the grisly, violent, cautionary tales from which they were derived. Of course, scary stories are best told by word of mouth. So we invited author Adam Gidwitz to share the rather horrible story Ashpuddle, or as you may know her, Cinderella. It is one of the tales from his new book, The Grim Conclusion, the third volume of delightfully dark, vividly retold stories originally gathered by the Brothers Grimm. Gidwitz was a longtime teacher and advises parents to read the book themselves before deciding to share it with kids. So in that spirit, be warned that the original tales can be quite gory.
Thank you, Virginia. This is indeed Cinderella, also known as Aschenputtel, collected by the Brothers Grimm. And you said it, but I have to say it also. This story can be a little bit frightening, a little bit disgusting, a little bit bloody. So if you don't like hearing stories like that, when I get to one of those parts, just take your two fingers and put them in your ears and count to five. And by the time you're finished counting, I'll be done with the gross, bloody part and we'll be good to go. I'm not going to start at the beginning because you know the story of Cinderella, and the grim version starts the way you think it's going to start. There's a girl, her name is Cinderella, or Aschenputtel. She lives with her mean stepsisters and stepmother. And the story goes as you expect it to until she gets to the ball. She meets the prince, dances with the prince, loses a shoe. The shoe actually doesn't happen to be made of glass. In the grim version, it's made of gold. From there, though, I think we can start. So the prince picks up the shoe and goes out to look for this girl, Cinderella, who's disappeared from his ball, and he goes to lots of different houses, and pretty soon he comes to Cinderella's house. And he holds out the shoe and he says, "Whoever's foot fits in this golden shoe will be my bride." Well, the stepsisters are thrilled, because you see, in a lot of versions of Cinderella, the stepsisters are ugly, right? Like, one is skinny like a chicken bone, the other one's fat like a kettle, neither one's particularly attractive. But in the real grim version of Cinderella, the stepsisters are very, very beautiful. Probably more beautiful than Cinderella. And they have perfect, beautiful little feet. So when the prince says, "Whoever's foot fits in this golden shoe will be my bride," they're thrilled. And the oldest stepsister flips her long golden hair and says, "Oh, let me try the shoe." And she goes and she takes the golden shoe and she goes into the back room and her stepmother follows her back. And she slides her perfect, beautiful little foot into the golden shoe, and it fits. Almost. Sorry. You see, her big toe is a little bit too big. She can't get it into the shoe. She tries and tries. It just will not fit. So the stepmother takes out a knife, and she says, "Cut off your toe. When you're queen, you won't have to walk anymore." Which is true, I guess, right? If you're queen, people, like, carry you around and stuff, right? Makes sense. So the stepsister takes the knife, cuts off her big toe, shoves her foot into the shoe, grits her teeth against the pain, and goes out to see the prince. And she hobbles out there, and you have to imagine that, you know, she wants to impress this prince. But it is not easy to impress a prince when you have just cut off your toe and shoved it into a golden shoe, because that probably hurts a lot. So she's gritting her teeth in unbearable pain, trying to smile at the same time, and she hobbles out there and she says, "It fits!" And the prince says, "My true bride." And he goes and he picks her up, carries her outside, puts her on his horse, and they ride away together. But they haven't gone very far when they pass the grave of Cinderella's real mother. And on this grave is a hazel tree. And in the tree are sitting two doves. And as the prince and the stepsister ride by, these two doves call out. They call out, "Coo, coo." There's blood in the shoe. The foot's too long, the foot's too wide. This is not the proper bride. Well, the prince pulls up his horse and stops and listens to the birds. Because when birds talk to you, you should listen, right? Anyway, he looks back at the stepsister with long golden hair and her beautiful dress and down to the golden shoe, and indeed, he sees blood burbling up out of the golden shoe. And he looks and he goes, "Wait a minute. This isn't the right girl." So he takes a horse, turns it around, rides back to the house, and says, "This is not the right girl. Do you have another daughter?" Well, they do. The second stepsister flips her long black hair, and she says, let me try the shoe. And she takes the golden shoe, and she goes into the back room, and the stepmother follows her back. And she slides her perfect, beautiful little foot into the golden shoe, and it fits. Almost. Yeah, you see, her heel is just a little bit too big. She can't get her heel to fit into the shoe. She tries and tries. It just will not go in. You might need your fingers now. So the stepmother takes out a knife, and she says, "Cut off a chunk of your heel." So the stepsister takes the knife, cuts off a chunk of her heel, shoves the foot in the shoe, grits her teeth against the pain, goes out to see the prince and says, "It fits!" And the prince says, "My true bride." And they ride away together. But they haven't gone very far when they pass a cemetery with the grave and the two doves on the tree. And the doves call out again. They call out, "Coo, coo. There's blood in the shoe. The foot's too long. The foot's too wide. This is not the proper bride." Well, the prince pulls up his horse and stops and listens to the birds, because, again, birds talk, you should listen. And he looks back at the stepsister with the long black hair and her beautiful dress and down to the golden shoe. And indeed, he sees blood burbling up out of the golden shoe. And he goes, "Wait a minute. This isn't the right girl either," because he's smart like that. So he takes the horse, turns it around, rides back to the house and says, "This is not the right girl. Do you have another daughter?" Well, they don't want to admit it. Cinderella's dirty. She's covered with ashes and cinders. But he insists. She gets cleaned up, comes downstairs, tries on the golden shoe, and it fits perfectly. And the prince says, "My true bride." And he picks her up, carries her outside, puts her on his horse. They ride away together, and they all live happily ever after. Almost. You see, they haven't gone very far when they pass the cemetery with the grave and the tree and the two doves, and the two doves call out again, but this time they call out, "Coo, coo, no blood in the shoe. The foot is neither long nor wide. This one is the proper bride." And they fly out of the tree and they come and they land on Cinderella's shoulders, one on her right shoulder, one on her left, and there they sit. Well, the next day, the whole kingdom comes to celebrate the wedding of Cinderella and the prince. And everybody's in the chapel, and Cinderella's outside the chapel about to walk in, when who should approach her but the two stepsisters? And these stepsisters, they're limping a little bit, right? But they're smiling, and they say, "Dear Cinderella, we love you so much. We're so happy for you. We're so glad that you're marrying the prince." And she says, "Dear sisters, come, walk with me in my wedding." So the older stepsister stands on her right, and the younger one stands on her left, and the two doves are still sitting on Cinderella's shoulders. And as Cinderella walks into the chapel, now you're going to need your fingers again for this, as Cinderella walks into the chapel, the dove on her right shoulder leans over to the older stepsister and pecks out her left eye. The other dove leans over to the younger stepsister and pecks out her right eye. After the wedding continues, which is really weird, because if you can imagine a wedding like da-da-da-da-da-da-da, ah-ah, and then da-da-da-da, it just keeps going. Weird but true. After the wedding, Cinderella turns around to leave, and when she turns around, now the younger stepsister is on her right, and the older one is on her left. So the two doves lean over and peck out the stepsister's two remaining eyes. And the last line of the real, grim version of Cinderella is, "And so the stepsisters were punished with blindness till the end of their days for being so wicked and false." The end.
The dreams that I wish will come true.
Well, well.
Well, well, those wicked stepsisters get what they deserve. Adam Gidwitz there summarizing a chapter from his new book, The Grimm Conclusion. It's an oddly humorous reimagining of the Grimm fairy tales collected by the brothers Grimm. Adam, delightful to hear you tell the story. And that's kind of the voice that you keep throughout these tales when you're writing. It's very naturalistic. You're kind of winking at your audience at the same time. Instead of telling them to plug their ears, you're saying, close your eyes during this next while you're reading this next paragraph. Tell me how you came up with that voice.
That voice came about totally organically. I was a teacher, and one day I got a phone call from my school, and they asked me if I'd be willing to be a substitute librarian for a day. And I said, yes. They said, great, you're going to be telling stories to second graders. I said, no problem. They said, tell them any story you want. I said, great. So I went home and I was looking around on my shelf for a good story to read to second graders, and I came across my big book of the real Grimm fairy tales. So I took the book off my shelf, opened it up to a story called Faithful Johannes, and in this story, two children get their heads cut off by their parents. It's okay, they get put back on again, so they're totally fine. But I thought, huh, can I read this to second graders? Will I get fired? And then I thought, let's find out. So I brought it in, and I started reading it to these kids. And very quickly, they started to get very nervous. So I would make a joke to calm them down a little bit, or I would warn them when something really terrible was about to happen. So that voice that you're referring to, that conversational, jokey, warning voice, comes literally from me first telling a grim fairy tale to those second graders.
And you interject throughout the stories to warn readers against sharing with little kids. So, it's,
yes.
So at what age do you think kids are ready to hear these unvarnished versions of the classic tales?
Well, I can't speak for all kids. I know seventh graders who my books are their favorite books. And I know 13-year-olds who said I had to quit after a chapter because I was having nightmares. I really think that kids know what they're ready for and they know what they need. And the wonderful thing about a book is it's really easy to close. So I knew a little girl, a 7-year-old girl. She was a friend of the family, and we were friends. She was a fan of my stories. And she started A Tale Dark and Grim, and she had to call me up and say, Adam, I couldn't read it. It was too scary. And I said, I'm so glad that you knew that about yourself. She called me up 6 months later and said, I read the whole thing. It was my favorite book.
Tell me about the story that you just told. Cinderella is what we hear. You gave us a much grittier version with, as you put it nicely, Aschenputtel. But what does the name originally come from?
Aschenputtel literally just means covered with ashes. Aschen means ashes, and Putel is sort of, I believe, a nonsense ending like Cinderella. Mm-hmm. If you were covered with ashes and cinders 200 years ago in Germany, your job was not only to clean out the chimneys and the fireplaces as we would currently think of. Your job was probably also to clean out the chamber pots. Now, if there are any kids listening, you don't know what a chamber pot is. A chamber pot is essentially a toilet that does not flush. So it's a little pot, and you leave it in the corner of your room, and you sit on the pot, and you do your business in the pot. And then you get up, and you leave your business in the pot, and then somebody has to come and clean your business out of the pot with ashes and cinders and water. So in other words, when they called her Cinderella, what they were actually calling her was toilet cleaner. That was her name, was toilet cleaner. So next time you see a little girl saying, you know, I want to be Cinderella, I want to be Cinderella, you know that what she's actually saying is, I want to be toilet cleaner. Don't tell her that, though, because she'll probably cry.
Your read of some of the classic fairy tales that have been presented for kids today, many of which have been adapted by Disney somewhere along the way, you call mind-numbingly boring. Now, first of all, when did that happen? When did they get so sanitized? And has Disney actually done the Brothers Grimm a disservice?
That's an interesting question. So they have been sanitized from the late 19th century onwards. They were first published in 1812 and revised again and again until the Brothers Grimm published the last edition in 1857. And really since then, various people, especially in England and America, have been sanitizing these stories. Disney knew that if he could get 4- and 5-year-olds watching his movies, he could make much more money than if just 10- or 8-year-olds were watching them. So he really sanitized them. And I don't hate the Disney versions at all. Like, you know, the singing mice are one of my favorite things. But there is a disservice because kids have seen these sanitized versions over and over again. So many times that by the time they're 6 or 7, they think that fairy tales are indeed mind-numbingly boring and they dismiss them out of hand. But the real fairy tales, Grimm and others, are incredible. They are scary. They are funny, and I really believe that they speak to deep needs, hopes, and fears that children have. And so they're very important for kids to be exposed to. Einstein famously said, if you want your child to be intelligent, read them fairy tales. If you want them to be more intelligent, read them more fairy tales. So it's a shame that we only show them the Disney movies now when they are such rich sources of inspiration and thought.
Adam Gidwitz, author most recently of The Grim Conclusion, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Adam's also author of two previous best-selling retellings or reimaginings of tales by the Brothers Grimm. You can find out much more about his work. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more Word of Mouth coming up after the break. Stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As Instagram passes its third birthday, a small but growing community of users are beginning to use the website for the private exchange of goods. 2 million of the site's annual photo uploads are items being put up for sale, with actual negotiations taking place via comment threads and private messages. Among the items being legally sold through Instagram are firearms. To find out more, producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Brian Reese, senior social media editor at The Daily Beast.
So how exactly would I search for firearms on Instagram? I mean, are they difficult to come across or are they right out there in the open?
You know, it's a layer or two to get to the actual sales of guns on Instagram. What I did to find them was actually use this website called Hashbag, HASHB.AG, which kind of filters everything down through the for sale hashtag. So once you're there, you can search for watches, for puppies, for Jeeps, for guns. And once I saw the guns were for sale, I was a little amazed.
And what kind of stuff is for sale there? I mean, are we talking about pistols, semi-automatics? You know, what's the range?
It really runs the whole range. I saw handguns, I saw Glocks, I saw shotguns, rifles, a few modified sniper rifles, a bunch of guns listed under the AR-15 hashtag, which some of them are assault rifles, some of them are just more consumer grade. I didn't find any grenade launchers, tanks, or anything of that caliber, thank goodness. But, you know, it's pretty much anything that you can buy at a normal gun shop, you can pretty much find it on Instagram.
Now, other major websites like Craigslist, eBay, they prohibit the sales of firearms. So why do you think Instagram is doing things a little differently?
Exactly. Well, Craigslist is pretty much, it's a marketplace. The site was created as classified sales portal, more or less, and that's what it's remained, whereas Instagram was a photo-sharing app that has comments. So for Instagram, in their point of view, it's just a platform. People use it to post photos of their babies. They're going to talk about the babies just as they would post photos of a gun and then talk about the gun. And there's essentially no way, I think, that Instagram or Facebook, which owns Instagram, can really hop in there and start censoring that stuff. Because if I post a photo of my gun and say, look what I just got for sale, suddenly I'm going to be into that same filter that others are using it to sell guns, and you really can't make that difference. So I think Instagram is essentially letting it be an open platform to letting the users dictate what's talked about there.
So for the most part, this is all legal. This is all legit.
It's pretty much totally legit. You know, I talked to the federal government, the ATF, and they were all basically telling me that while they don't necessarily enjoy the online marketplaces of guns, whether that is Facebook, even on Twitter, Instagram, people are going to sell guns just as they would do when they walk out on the street in front of a grocery store. They could talk. As long as you're in the state, you can have private sellers sell to private sellers. That's going to happen online. It's going to happen off.
Is there anything happening in terms of on Instagram that you would say crosses that line? Is there anything that's illegal?
Nothing I saw, and I was actually amazed. Everyone I spoke with about five different individuals who had posted a gun for sale on Instagram, and they all very much respect their local laws, very much respect the federal laws, and they all say they are, you know, proud American gun owners who are just trying to sell the gun that they happened to pick up earlier. So I'm not too worried about that. However, up here in New York, we did have a hip-hop artist who was also a gun smuggler get busted because he was actually posting photos of his guns and the money he was making on Instagram. You know, while he wasn't directly selling there, you can see how that line can start to get blurred.
And that's where some people might start to get concerned.
Well, speaking of people getting concerned, I was wondering if you or anybody you spoke to feels that Instagram or parent company Facebook should have a greater responsibility when it comes to gun sales on the website, even if it technically isn't breaking any laws.
Right, yeah. I did speak with a couple of people who felt that Instagram could be doing more in terms of monitoring sales of guns or other goods that aren't so family-friendly because, you know, the site is open to 13-year-olds. At the same time, you know, like I said, I'm not really sure what Instagram could do because they're not a commerce site. If they ever do start letting retailers sell more ads that direct the users to the point of sale, at that point they might want to start filtering out ages that could actually access the material. But at this point in time, from the ATF to the individuals I spoke with, most are saying as long as you're following the local laws, there shouldn't be that big of a problem with it. Then again, I did speak with a staff attorney with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing, you know, legal expertise in support of gun violence prevention. And they weren't exactly excited about it because of the fact that no background check is required. But then again, everyone points to the Fix Gun Checks Act of 2013, which was shut down in the Senate back in April of 2013. That would have closed that private sale loophole, which would essentially then make sure everyone who's selling guns have to go through the federal licensees.
If this trend evolves, what other platforms might we see hosting this kind of private comment-based firearm exchange?
Well, as some of my critics online mentioned these last few days, you know, this is happening on Twitter, it's happening on Facebook, it's been happening on all sorts of forums since the beginning of the internet. It's really endless the amount of places that someone could go out there and sell a gun. It's, in a sense, Instagram is the mirror. What's happening there is happening elsewhere, and again, it all comes back to the law. If the law is going to allow private sales, the law is going to allow it online and off.
Brian Reese is senior social media editor at The Daily Beast. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You'll find a link to Brian's article about gun sales on Instagram at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find more on Facebook and on Twitter. Researchers at the Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center in Lebanon are developing mobile apps to assess and treat patients who have severe mental illness. These apps could help patients in crises and also help them manage their illnesses in the crucial time between doctor visits. Liz Fiella reports.
Jose Caraballo lives in Chicago. Recently, he experienced symptoms of schizophrenia.
I have racing thoughts, not thinking well, feel confused where I'm going when I get out of my house.
Soon after, he heard about a new study involving a mobile app called Focus. The app was developed by researchers at Dartmouth College.
Let's put it to the test. Hello, have you been bothered by voices today?
That's Dr. Dror Benzev. He's a researcher at the Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center and part of the team working on the Focus application. His app asks patients about their symptoms.
It says, do you think that the voices are uncontrollable, all-knowing, powerful, or a symptom of your condition?
Then it gives suggestions.
Try this experiment. Take a moment and think of one thing that the voices were wrong about in the last week. Go ahead, you can do it. Thumbs up icon on it. It gives you very quick and dirty real-time interventions that can help someone in the moment.
In the digital age, Benzev says, mental health apps have a wide reach. A recent study out of Dartmouth found that 72% of people with severe mental illness had a mobile device.
There are more mobile phones in the world than toothbrushes and far more than toilets.
Dr. John Kane is a professor of psychiatry at Hofstra University. He directs the Advanced Center for Interventions and Services Research in Schizophrenia. Up till now, he says, mental health care has been slow to join the emerging field of mobile health, or mHealth, but things are changing. Recent mass shootings have drawn attention and grant money to the need to address severe mental illness quickly.
The tragedy is that people with schizophrenia are not inherently violent.
Kane thinks using apps to intervene early will limit the problems that come with untreated psychosis, including crisis medical care. Statistics from the National Institute of Mental Health show 1 in 100 Americans have schizophrenia.
The costs are enormous, so if you look at a visit to an emergency room or a hospitalization, we're talking about tremendous costs.
But the goal of the doctors working on the Focus app goes beyond averting trips to the hospital. Again, Dr. Dror Benzev.
Our objective is recovery and high functioning.
I'm on the faculty at the medical school at Dartmouth. I run my own company.
That's Dr. Patricia Deacon. Long before she got her PhD in psychology and founded a software company, Deacon was diagnosed with schizophrenia. She was 17. Her psychiatrist gave her what she calls a prognosis of doom. She would never get better, and she'd have to be medicated her entire life.
And I remember walking out of the office, and I just felt this really angry indignation rise up inside of me. And I just remember thinking to myself, you're wrong. You're wrong about who I am. I am going to be somebody.
Now Deacon develops mental health apps, including one called Common Ground. It helps people with severe mental illness work with their doctors to make decisions about their treatment plans. Though many people live with mental illness their whole lives, Deacon says it's a vulnerability you can manage.
To live in recovery means to have a job, get a paycheck, and have a date on a Friday night. You know, you're living your life outside of the human services landscape.
And according to Deacon and others who live with mental illness, that life between doctor's visits is where a lot of recovery takes place. Back in Chicago, Jose Caraballo says that his mental health app helped him take steps to manage his illness in his daily life.
Well, sometimes a focus application come on and it reminds me, have you talked to someone? How many people have you contacted today?
The focus app is in clinical trials, and it might be a while before it goes public. In the meantime, Dr. Ben Zev and Dr. Kane are working on another app. This one gathers information about changes in patients' speech, sleep, and activity patterns that precede a psychotic episode.
The next time around where we see that combination of behaviors that we think might be dangerous for that individual, we'll communicate through messaging on the phone and to their clinical team that we think that that person might be at especially high risk and it might make sense to have more outreach and better care.
Ben Zev says the future of mobile health is care that's personalized and there when you need it. Schizophrenia? Pretty soon, there'll be an app for that. I'm Liz Viella.
Early in October, one of the largest nuclear reactors in the world was forced to shut down after a swarm of jellyfish flooded and clogged its water cooling pipes. The bloom of jellyfish that devastated Sweden's Oskarshamn nuclear plant is symptomatic of a global problem. Research out of the University of British Columbia shows a 62% increase in jellyfish blooms since 1950. Proliferation of the species has been crippling fishing and tourism all over the world. Blooms are increasing in frequency, intensity, and duration. Gwyn Guilford reported on the proliferation, which appears in large part to be related to the impact of humans on the oceans. We read her reporting in Quartz. And Gwyn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
We mentioned the case of the nuclear reactor in Sweden. What are some other cases of jellyfish causing damage, and what kind of damage?
Well, they do frequently clog cooling systems of plants like the one in Sweden, nuclear plants, but also desalination plants and natural gas plants as well. And this is happening all over the world. It's happened in Israel, Maryland, California. But then there's also, you know, fishing. It's devastated fishing, explosion of jellyfish populations. For instance, in Japan. Japan has the world's biggest jellyfish. They're about the size of a telephone booth. They weigh about 440 pounds. In 2009, fishermen caught so many of these jellyfish they actually capsized and sunk their trawler.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, but pretty much every year these giant Nomura jellyfish appear and cost Japanese fishermen usually hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. How has tourism been affected?
It's hard to get numbers on this, but it's becoming a really big problem in the Mediterranean. Areas where tourism is their main source of income are basically limited to maybe a week-long window now where there aren't jellyfish blooms. Also, you know, people are getting stung a lot. Mediterranean's definitely the biggie, but with the research showing that this is very likely going to continue, this explosion of jellyfish, you know, we can expect it to have a bigger impact on tourism elsewhere, too.
I also see here in the Black Sea, invasive comb jellyfish in 1982 wiped out a $350 million fishing industry. But aside from economic concerns, what kind of safety threats do jellyfish pose to humans?
There are a few jellyfish that are highly lethal. The box jellyfish is the most venomous creature on the planet. They're mainly in Australia, but they're starting to turn up in Florida, Wales. And there's also another, it's a relative of the box jellyfish. It's called the Irukandji. It's about the size of, you know, maybe like a AA battery. And it is also incredibly lethal. It can cause brain hemorrhages, heart failure, and those are turning up in Florida also.
Why are jellyfish spreading so quickly all across the world?
There are a few factors that scientists think are behind this. The one they know for sure is that, you know, as cargo shipping has expanded, ships take on water to balance out the cargo and then release it. They basically transport species from one ecosystem to another.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about tens of millions of gallons of ballast water, right?
Exactly. And so you mentioned the Black Sea. That was a result of invasive species of jellyfish being transferred to this system where it didn't have any natural predators, and it totally wiped everything out, including that, you know, $350 million fishing industry. So that factor scientists have been able to document, but this isn't a very well-funded area of science. So these are still in the hypothesis phase, but pollution is a big one. Overfishing, you know, when you wipe out the predators that eat jellyfish or compete with them for food, you basically invite their populations to explode.
Mm-hmm. And what does pollution do?
What pollution does is when you have fertilizer and sewage and things like that flushed into the ocean, there's more dying fish and more excrement, and that strips oxygen from the water, mm-hmm. and it creates areas where fish basically can't live. Fish can't live there, but jellyfish can.
Hmm.
I was talking about the Nomura jellyfish, the giant telephone booth size.
Uh-huh.
Scientists think that the explosion of their population is caused by runoff from the Yangtze River in China.
We're speaking with Gwen Guilford. She's a reporter and editor at Quartz, and she wrote about the alarming proliferation of jellyfish all over the world in ports, beaches, ships, and infrastructure. So a lot of evidence, it sounds like, that human activity has actually contributed to the spread of jellyfish. Can't we kill them off?
That gets to the most amazing thing about jellyfish, which is also probably the scariest. And it's basically their peculiar biology is such that in addition to reproducing, they also clone themselves. So once their populations start growing, there's a tipping point, and after you pass that, it's very hard to bring their populations back down. You could kill them, but their bodies are still there. They'll still clog a nuclear reactor cooling system. South Korean scientists came up with, like, basically a kind of lawnmower to hack them all up, and that's a terrible idea because that basically accelerates their cloning process.
Well, you know, from your description, it sounds like invasion of the jellyfish. Where will this end, and how could the tide turn?
That's a great question. I think that probably one big thing humans could do to sort of stem this explosion is overfishing. That is something that we, you know, do have control over minimizing.
Mm-hmm.
And pollution, yeah, that definitely is something that we can lessen. However, aquaculture, you know, fish farming or crustacean mm-hmm. farming, mm-hmm. massive contributor to the pollution that causes those dead zones that cause, in turn, jellyfish to thrive. You know, in order to eat the amount of seafood we want to eat, we need to have aquaculture. 90% of it comes from Asia. Those developing economies are, you know, their appetites for seafood is increasing with their spending power, and that's just going to keep growing. So there are some underlying macroeconomic factors that make the situation look pretty gloomy as far as, like, bringing down the number of jellyfish.
Gwen, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Gwen Guilford, general reporter and editor for Quartz magazine. She wrote, Attack of the Blob, Jellyfish Are Taking Over the Seas, and It Might Be Too Late to Stop Them. You can read the article, look at some of the graphics and the photographs at wordofmouthradio.org.
Thanks so much for spending some of your listening time with us today. If you like what you heard, you can pass it along. You can post segments on Facebook or Twitter or email them to friends. The links are easy to find on our Facebook page or at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah.